Hey, it's good to welcome you back to another podcast from the Morningstar Men's Ministry Saturday Morning Study. We are in the sixth and final week of our Every Father Needs to Know series. This week we're going to look at the dual topics of appreciation and self-discipline. We'll approach them in the opposite order, self-discipline first and then appreciation. As happens sometimes, because of the nature of this topic, there's some lively interaction that takes place. And this is a topic that is really rich with the potential for some understanding, some new understanding for all of us, not only as men, but also as fathers. And more than just understanding, just considering how we help children at each age level to appreciate how, as we explore in this week, how self-discipline is actually a key to happiness, and how gratitude and appreciation are at times the very thing that prevents us from becoming obsessed with a culture of more. I think you're going to find this to be particularly helpful, both to you as a man and to you as a father, and also I believe it will really be a blessing to your children as they begin to understand this. So, we look forward to catching up with you next week. If you follow along with this week by week, next Saturday, we're going to do a review and wrap up. We're going to consider all the six topics together, understand how they connect with each other. So I'm looking forward to being with you at that time as well. In the meantime, hope you have a great Thanksgiving, and we'll see you all again next week. All right. Again, a couple of thoughts about where we're headed. This is the last of the 6 weeks. Next week, we're going to do a review. Don't assume that just because I'm using the word review, that it's not going to be worth being here, because we're going to introduce some new material to see how all of these ideas link together. And then remember I said immediately following that, we're going to do 2 weeks on how to prepare and present material, because I'm hoping to develop a few more group leaders, a few people that might actually like to be up here on a Saturday morning. So you'll want to be here for that. After that, we're just going to do very informal Bible study. Just show up here if you're available. It's not going to be fancy. There may be no handouts. We're just going to sit here as a group of guys, open up a Bible, and talk about a particular text. So I'll probably provide some guidance for that. Maybe we'll dumb it down to like only 3 pages of notes then, and we'll move ahead from there. Okay. So, two basic topics for the morning. We're going to look at discipline / self-discipline. And then after that, we're going to look at appreciation. The overarching theme for both of these topics is, how do I find life satisfaction? Can you think back to a time when you were young and you chased after happiness? Now, I know none of us does that anymore. We're well beyond that. We're pretty sophisticated. But can you think back to when you were in your early 20s? Some of you don't have to think very far back. Can you think back that far? And that was the focus of my life. I wanted to be happy, I wanted to be satisfied, and I chased after things that would do that for me. All right. If you're bold enough to admit, how did your formula for seeking happiness and life satisfaction work? In what ways did it work, in what ways didn't it? All right, now, many of us are parents. Some of us are actually past the parenting phase. We're into the grandparenting phase. Or some of us want to be parents. And your children are going to experience the same basic desires. There's things that I believe will make me happy. There's methods of living my life that are going to bring me the greatest satisfaction. How many of you have teenagers? All right, or almost like wannabe teenagers. Okay. Has anyone in the room ever been accused of ruining a child's life? Two. Okay, two. All right, for the rest of you, that day is coming. It's as predictable as the North Star is reliable. Why? At the moment when you were striving diligently to ruin their life, what were you actually trying to do?
Guide.
Those are three great words. Protect, educate, guide.
Save them from making mistakes that I made.
Okay. And yet they didn't appreciate that at the moment. So, Today, remember the focus here, and I've said it almost every week, it's easy to get lost in the material and start to think this is about me. Well, yes it is, but not really. Yes, it's about you because you have to understand it before you can help your children to understand it, but the primary reason we're here today is to figure out how to help our children understand this stuff. So the first two things, discipline and then self-discipline. You need to understand the principles so you can help your children to understand the principles. What do you suppose is the difference between discipline and self-discipline?
One comes from somebody else.
That's pretty clean, simple, and to the point.
I think you look into yourself as self-discipline. See how you measure up to where you're at.
Okay, so discipline of one sort or another is externally regulated. Someone else sets the law, someone else imposes the rule of law, someone monitors the law, and then someone else administers the punishment for when the law is breached or broken. All right? Self-discipline requires me to be all of them. It requires me to develop the law. It requires me then to administer the law. It requires me to impose sanctions on myself should I violate the law. I mean, we don't look at it quite that way, but in reality, that's what it is. So if we were to say it like this, how do we teach our kids self-discipline? We start by imposing some discipline. Okay, that I step up to become the administrator of the law in my life. I agree that I'm going to submit to the law. Good point. We're going to look at that when we distinguish between a disciple and the word discipline, where we're going to see some overlap there. So how do we usually do this? Let's say this is discipline of one sort or another, and typically we help our kids to stay inside that. So this is the fence that we impose. And we regularly try to help our kids stay inside that fence. And this is the invisible dog fence illustration, right? We put a fence around the outside of the yard. We put the little flags there. The dog sees the flag. You're supposed to make the association between the flag and the electronic shock. And gradually the dog, in theory at least, until it sees the hot dog next door, learns to stay inside the fence.
Sometimes that hot dog next door is worth the shot. Those shocking collars are worth the shot, too.
Okay. The dog next door was just supposed to be a funny distraction momentarily. Let's not take us down a side trail there, or it could go bad very quickly.
The other circle with belief and understanding and knowledge being the inner workings of what generally control that.
All right. What distinguishes, apart from this, what distinguishes between discipline and self-discipline?
The pain between the two.
Okay, what else?
You're not going past that on your own instead of having someone.
Okay.
For those, a dog's going to count the cost. Even a dog will count the cost. I'm not too sure that's worth it.
Any other differences? Yeah.
When you're self-disciplined, because you realize that it's better for you. Like some simple, I teach my kids brushing your teeth. Like, you don't have to. I put it in place to protect you, but you don't have to. And foster kids come in our house, they're notorious for not having good hygiene, dental hygiene. And I teach them, if you don't, this is what happens. You'll be in a lot of pain. You'll have to go to the dentist. Is that better or worse for you? And they start to realize that I should brush my teeth, and then they start to have a self-discipline to take care of themselves. I think that kind of applies, you know, once they start realizing it's actually better for you to live peacefully, like Jesus said, you don't need all these laws to tell you to live peacefully. You should from your heart, because ultimately it's better for you.
And there's the difference. There's the key distinguisher. When discipline is imposed, I might not understand the purpose for it. By the time I start to impose discipline on myself, I should understand the purpose for it. And this is what we have to help our children to understand. The discipline for discipline's sake is nothing but religion. Self-discipline has a purpose behind it. So think about all the people who do discipline stuff, and they actually think somehow, have you ever felt superior because your life looked more in control? No one in the room really understands that, huh? Have you ever judged somebody else because it appeared to you that their life was less under control? And you thought, well, I've got it pretty much together. Well, here's what we tend to do. We pit our strengths against their weaknesses. So here's what I know about me, and I also know it's true about you. There's not one of us in this room that doesn't struggle with discipline in one area of life. I'm not saying in all areas of life, I'm just saying in one. There's not one of us that doesn't have the thing that we're constantly fighting the temptation toward. All right? And some of you are looking at me with the most baffled looks. Now here's what we have to help our children to do. Self-discipline is always connected to purpose and mission. And so when I, as a parent, draw these external boundaries, they're based on generic purpose and mission. What we have to help our children to do is to create internal boundaries, and at times they're going to come outside of our boundaries, and at other times they're going to be very much inside of our boundaries. Do any of you have children that play a musical instrument and you don't? Do any of you have children that do anything else that you don't? And so we help them to acquire a self-discipline of doing something that they don't, which means carving out time, exercising a commitment to something, and in that way, the fence of their discipline starts to look different than ours. And so our mission is to help them not just to understand the value of discipline, but to connect it to their life purpose. Because otherwise, people who are self-disciplined, but apart from purpose, are cranky, miserable, irritable people. That's just the way it is. Why? Because they don't know why they don't do certain things. They just don't do them because they think somehow it's going to earn them some extra bounty points. But from who? Listen, I don't care if you're more disciplined in certain areas, if it has nothing to do with your purpose. Now, why does this matter? And why are we connecting it to satisfaction and happiness? Because I believe this. And this is kind of like this really quirky thing that over a period of time I started to study personally. So this collection here is on the list of six only because over a period of 20 or 30 years I started to look at people's lives that I most admired, and I realized that one of the common themes was they were incredibly self-disciplined in the areas that I admired the most. That an absence of self-discipline over time actually starts to deprive people of the ability to perform at the highest level. So think of the thing that you are best at in life, whatever that is. And chances are there is some connection between it and a level of discipline that you've imposed on yourself. And yet, when I introduce the word discipline and I put it side by side with the word happiness, do the two seem to fit? Discipline and happiness. No, you're too old. You already know the right answer, okay? Well, you're too old on a number of counts, but you already know the right answer, and I'm older than you, so I'm just, that makes me worse.
Happiness, I'm not so sure.
How about contentment, satisfaction?
Joy. Like there's a difference. Because when I'm disciplined with something, I can be happy for a minute. But the payday's going to come when I'm undisciplined with something. You know what I mean? There's going to come a payday. And when I'm undisciplined with anything, someone else has to be disciplined. Now somebody else has to be disciplined to clean up what I was undisciplined about or with.
I can remember being in my early 30s and finally breaking down and saying, you know what, I wish my dad had spanked me for something that taught me if boundary was real. I didn't have any of that. There was no consequence for what I did until I was standing before a judge and back in a police car.
Well, all depends on how much you spank.
My dad is criticizing, and I think that would have helped me to have some sense of structure instead of a dad who wasn't there at all.
Well, my dad kicked the belt all the time. We feared him. We didn't want to get away. We didn't want to, you know. There was a point to being there. leading differently. I don't know if it really works.
Well, I think here's the thing.
What's discipline without reason? You were talking about it earlier. What's discipline without reason? With no reason. No outcome. Just discipline.
Are you talking imposed by others or self-discipline?
He's like our dad, we didn't always need a reason. Pow, down you go. You know, we were disciplined without giving a reason. So I looked at that as like, he's just me.
Okay.
He was in his own head. He had a reason and he wanted me to be whatever it was, but he never explained that.
Okay, and there's two factors that you brought up here that we need to address. The one is, it's not enough to impose discipline. You have to be very clear about the reason for imposing discipline on your children, and also to help them. The sooner that they can discipline themselves, the sooner that they can stay inside the boundary that they know that you have for them, the easier life goes for them. But there's another thing here, and that is that parents who are not self-disciplined in their discipline will create exactly what you're talking about, because a self-disciplined form of disciplining understands the purpose for the discipline and regulates itself so it doesn't overstep its own boundaries. You understand what I just said? That is critical. So when you and I, as parents or grandparents, discipline, and who hasn't done this, in some form of anger, then our own lack of self-discipline has spilled over into the life of the child or the grandchild or the next-door neighbor or whatever the case may be.
And if that circle, like our that circle's real big, but our circle was this big, and so it felt real constraining. It was like, man, I can't do anything. Where Vinny's circle kind of was looped all over the place. You know what I mean? So it was different.
Yeah. What was that for? That's what for you got away with, or I didn't know.
Okay, so we move on to the next question. This is not a new question. You've heard me ask this before. If the position of being your life manager was a hired job, in other words, if you could request applicants for the job of managing your own life, would you be the best candidate for the job? Now just think about that. Would you be the person most qualified to be the manager of your life? And ultimately, you should be able to say yes to that. So to the degree that you can say yes to that, and why should you be the one best qualified? And I'm talking in a human sense. We'll get into some other details. Or do you really think that there are other people that would be better qualified to manage your life? Now why should you ideally be the person most qualified to manage your life?
I'm older now, so I can't unknow things. You know what I mean? Like, I can't unknow what happened.
Mm-hmm.
I know me. I can sell myself anything if I want bad enough. I can sell myself anything if I want bad enough. I need an outside force to say, no. No. No, you don't need that. No, that's going to be trouble. No, that's, you know what I mean? Like, there's something outside of me that still, even as heck towards 50, you know, says, you know what, hold on. But I have a team of people that do that for me.
Okay, you have advisors.
Oh, yeah.
All right, well, we're not talking about advisors, but who has the final veto authority in your life? To the advisors or to you?
Well, I mean, with these, I do what I want.
Okay, so you have the final veto power in your life. Yes or no, all gets down to you. No matter how large a council of advisors you have, the veto is yours.
I guess, yeah.
Okay. Come back to the question. We want our children to engage in constructing self-discipline in their own lives. Why are they, or why should they be, as adults, the best qualified to manage their own life? We've already said it, but I need you to connect the two.
You gave them the boundaries. You teach them.
We've taught them boundaries, but here's the thing. Remember we said that self-discipline is always connected to life mission and life purpose. Right? They construct life mission and life purpose for themselves. It's not my job to impose my idea of their life's mission on them. It's their responsibility as adults to be able to craft their own life mission and purpose and therefore impose on themselves the standards that are best going to help them to do that. Because all self-discipline is ultimately, if it's to be meaningful, designed to help us to excel at the things that we've committed to excel at. Wouldn't you agree? That's its whole purpose for being there. Remember, that's why we said that when self-discipline isn't connected to purpose, all it creates is miserable, cranky people. And truthfully, we've met some of them. All right, so top of page 2, that would be the back side of your first page. Does that sound right? All right, so discipline, and in this case we're going to use the word discipline now interchangeably with self-discipline. Discipline helps us to say yes to some things, no to others. It will allow us to say now to some things, later to other things, and perhaps to a certain category of things, and never to a fourth class of things. So it's pretty much all-encompassing. What in your life do you know that you need to say never to? Okay? Are there things that are wrong for you individually that aren't wrong for others?
Yes.
Okay, so my list of nevers and your list might have some things in common, but there might be some things that are different. I can never get near this. I struggle with that. Now, because we're a group of men, I can use this illustration and you'll get it. For me, it becomes a challenge 7 days a week to be at the gym. Now, I go to the gym 7 days a week, but I'm telling you, I need to limit my gym time. Not because it's bad for me physically, but because there's a lot of, we'll say, physically fit women at the gym. Has anybody ever heard of Patrick Morley?
Sure.
Now, okay, Patrick Morley is a leading men's ministry guy around the country. Here was Morley's observation. He said, I think if I spent more than an hour a day at the gym, it would ruin me.
What gym are you going to?
Why, are you jealous? Because
you gotta start getting cheap.
That's what I'm going to, not so much.
Maybe it's the time of day, John. So that was a humorous example, but are there things that you have to very carefully monitor? Maybe, in limitation. Are there things that you know you need to say yes to? Now, how do we have these conversations with our children? This is important. See, because if all we do is build the fence and tell them stay inside the fence, what are they going to grow up thinking?
What's outside the fence?
Well, they're not. Oh, that's a great one.
What is it?
What's outside the fence?
Reverse psychology.
What else? So remember, we're equipping launch-worthy adults. What's going to happen the first time that your children encounter things that you didn't give them a rule for? Yeah.
At some point, they make their own rule. They start to make their own rule.
So wouldn't it be better to discuss life situations in the broadest of terms and help them to define their own values, what's important to them, and therefore help them, even though, and exactly like Jim said, there's days when I need a counselor. There's days when I need to be surrounded by people who are going to influence me to do the right thing. Our children need that. But ultimately, we're turning the baton of life over to them and helping them to be able to decide when to say yes, when to say no, and when to say later or immediately.
But there's never that time, which I don't believe that we do. It happens, but I don't think we ever want to do this to where we just boot them out of the nest, there you go, have a nice one. That's not what happens. When they encounter something that is outside the fence, they pick up the phone and they go, yo, Dad, this is outside the fence. That first child, that is way outside the fence. I don't know what to do. How do I do this? Well, I've never encountered this.
And this is one of the challenges, specifically, I'll talk to us as men. There's a general theory that says that men are more rules-oriented and women are more relationally oriented. And you see this play out in very small and subtle ways. Right, the example that I always use is the friend of mine, and it's still to this day just so insanely stupid, and yet it really illustrates the difference. So my buddy comes to me one day and he says, I can't believe what she said to me. She said to me, would you rather be right or would you rather be married? And that was the essence of the difference between relationship and rules. Some of you, it took a few moments for that to catch on. In one way or another, every guy has had that conversation in his house. Right? I mean, why do you think there are cliche-ish jokes about, like, if a man says something in the middle of the woods and no one is around to hear it, is he still wrong? Right? That didn't come into being by accident.
That love covers a multitude of sins first. I'll be honest, my wife gets away with some things at home that I have to remind myself, love covers a multitude of sin. That exactly. Do I want to be happy or do I want to be right? Sometimes being right isn't worth anything. It doesn't keep peace in the marriage. It doesn't set a good example for
me. But you know what? That is a part of the discipline process. I need to learn how to pick my battles. I need to learn how to do that. Because if I'm the authoritarian who's just always on something, I'm tired all the time, I'm angry all the time, I have to learn to pick my battles. Because I do the same thing. Sometimes Barbara does something and I'm like, she actually thanked me. We were redoing our bedroom, tipped the tray off of the ladder onto the floor. And I did not flip out. So that night,
it goes both ways.
I just, she didn't thank me. She knows that that's one of those things that might set me off. But she said, hey, thanks for not flipping out.
Okay, now, let's bring this into the realm of parenting. And all I'm saying to us as guys is it's easy for us to become obsessed with this and forget why we're putting this in place to begin with. We put the rules in place for the benefit of our children, helping them to be able to establish their own. So when they violate this boundary, if our head is in the right space, what's our attitude?
What did you learn?
You've hurt yourself in this, not me. Now, if all of your rules and discipline are arbitrary, well, then that's a different thing. But in reality, if we have imposed these boundaries based on our own wisdom, the wisdom of our council of advisors and godly principles, if we've placed the boundaries because of that, then we can say to our children, I love you, and this is hurting you more than it is hurting me. But and here's where we get drawn into our own emotional battle. What do? It becomes a tug of emotional will. Right? And pretty soon, well, I don't care what you think. These are the rules. It's my way, or...
I'm just thinking. Parenting...
Is that rare?
Yes.
Oh.
Isn't it possible that if you parent extremely well, your child's boundaries can exceed your own?
Oh, absolutely. We've already said that in many cases they're going to have to in certain areas.
But then it's important to which your children now become your counselor to reel you back into a limited boundary.
No.
Go ahead, Jim.
The boundaries are the same. The boundaries are the boundaries. I've given them the same boundaries that I have. But I'm older and I get to pick whether I want to step outside of those boundaries or not. But it's too late now because now they see you stepping outside of your own boundaries and they go, hey, how come you can do that and I can't do that? My man just told me that. Yeah, well, when you're 18, you can do whatever you want.
Do what I say, not as I do.
But for now, just shut up and do what I told you.
Well, okay, so since we went down this side trail, and it's not a bad trail.
It's just what happens sometimes.
But your children should be able to point to things in your life where you're still learning. So you begin your journey as a parent, and maybe you're in your mid-20s, maybe you're in your early 20s. All right. So by the time they're in their teens, where does that place you? This is not higher math. Where does that place you? Okay. Shouldn't you be wiser and better informed about making decisions by that time? Shouldn't they be able to see some things in your life where you have gradually modified your stance and your position on something? If they never see you learn anything and your personal boundaries are exactly the same for the entirety of their tenure at home, then what does it say about you? And then, of course, you're going to have to manage this. And I really didn't even think about this until just now. But you're going to have to manage the fact that this fence is going to expand gradually for each child. Right? When they're very young, you don't let them near the stove, hypothetically. And then when they get a little bit older, you let them near the stove, but you don't let them touch the stove. And then gradually, one day, you actually even learn to let them cook. But in the same house where you have one child that's learning to cook, so that boundary is really expanded, you've got another child that's still not old enough to touch the stove. So the challenge becomes, how do I manage different fences for different children within one household? Okay, I think we're moving on. It's good that you're both at the same table. I'm not sure who should be whose counselor at this moment, but... All right, I want us to read this thing. It's on page 2 for you, middle of the page. Joy is the happiness I experience as a result of moving toward my purpose-filled goals. This is why I can be joyful even in the midst of difficulty. Pleasure, on the other hand, is temporary and experience-based. And here's the interesting thing. And all of this is empirically based. In other words, they actually studied human lives to do this. Only about 10% of happiness can actually be registered and attributed to external circumstances. 10%. The remainder is based on internal thinking and careful practices. So if you want to set your children up for life satisfaction, it's more about teaching them how to think than it is about surrounding them with cool stuff. In other words, and this is actual human beings interviewed. The guy says he interviewed one woman in her late 40s. And he said, she should have been one of the most miserable and unhappy people that you would ever meet. She'd lost her husband just the year before, and it was a good marriage. So her life mate was gone. She was struggling with some sort of cancer. One of her children was sick. Another one was in rebellion. She said, this lady should have, by all external standards, been miserable. And yet, he said, and yet she was one of the most joyful people you would ever want to meet. And that example was not unusual. Digging deeper into people's lives, that example, he said, was exactly what I found in most cases. That only 10% of all the things that we think matter in life to our happiness actually do, and most of it is what happens in the small amount of real estate between our ears. How do we teach our children to think gratefully and with an attitude of satisfaction about life? Now, before we answer that question, and that's going to be the focus of the second half of today, before we answer that question, we got to move from discipline to habit. Because this is the rubber meets the road part of things. So discipline is what I force myself to do, if you will. Discipline is the pre-dawn run that I take. Discipline is the extra 20 minutes at the piano. Discipline is the extra time that I spend reading that I didn't have to. Whatever it is for you, that's what discipline is. How does that feel? Okay, has no one ever exerted personal discipline in their life?
The discipline is the force yourself part.
Yes, it is.
Habit is easy. Why? It just happens. And after you've worked out long enough, you go, you know what? I need a little more weight. It's too easy. You know, and if I'm trying, if I have a, what I was going to say, and I got to go, is the goal is the difference between the two. There's a goal in mind. One of the terms, pleasure doesn't have a goal in it, but discipline has a goal in it. There was a goal. And what I've discovered is people without goals are usually miserable. They're not looking forward to anything. They're not looking forward to finishing anything. They just are. And a lot of times they're miserable. I'm like, well, go do something. Go, you know what I mean?
I wish you could be around for the second part of this, because I'd love to just use that illustration right there to... Thanks, Jim. All right, so what happens at that moment when you know you should do something, but you're still debating about whether you will? Come on, we've all been there. Should I go back to the buffet again, or was one plate full enough? Should I, it looks cold out there, should I go out there and run, or shouldn't I? Have you ever been in the moment of decision there? How hard is it? What happens? Why don't you tell me what happens at that moment?
Deductive reasoning, yes. Sitting there thinking, well, what's best for me or whatever? What do I gain out of this or what do I gain out of that?
Let's use just what he said. And so it becomes a cost to benefit evaluation on every single instance. Right? How does that work? It's exhausting. Have any of you ever seen the movies that were done where they put cookies on a plate and kids in a room and the kids are told they're going to get twice as much of something later on? And most of us have seen that. But we really don't understand the purpose to those experiments. The purpose to the experiment actually has nothing to do with kids and cookies and marshmallows and prizes. What it has to do with is measuring the exertion that personal discipline takes. So what they do is they place people in circumstances like that where they have to use their willpower and they use their self-discipline to say no to this so that they can get that later. But that's really the setup just to tax their discipline, because then later what they introduce people to is challenging mental problems. And they say, can you solve this? And what they've found again and again is that people who agonize over forcing themselves to do or not to do something deplete their reserves of discipline. To the point that later on, when something else important comes along, they have less reserve of discipline. So in that way, what we've discovered is discipline is actually like a muscle. If you use it repeatedly and extensively, it tires. And this is the role that habit starts to come in and play. Once I move something from a discipline to a habit, I no longer think about it. It no longer becomes a daily evaluation. Put it into the spreadsheet and see what are the benefits of doing this right at this moment. What are the liabilities? And so habit then becomes the thing that serves us well. But have you ever started to get in a habit? Have you ever gotten into a habit? Have you ever walked with a habit for years, not realizing that it no longer served the purpose that it did at the beginning? You're all looking at me so perplexed today. I don't get this. Okay, I'll tell a story about myself. Maybe this will help. All right? So for years, I started my day with probably an hour of reading. Over the last 3 or 4 years, I've started to evaluate whether that's still a useful habit. Now, it's not that I don't read. It's just that what I've discovered is that the more I want to create, the less time I have to look at other people's ideas. In other words, by now, I've gotten to the point that I actually have a few ideas of my own that I need to get down. And every hour that I spend looking at other people's ideas is an hour that I don't have to put my own ideas down and codify them and organize them. And so what I've started to discover is there are habits that serve us well for a period of time. They don't necessarily serve us well for a lifetime. The problem with habit is that we no longer think about it, though. Like, do you think about brushing your teeth every day? That was a great illustration. It's actually in here somewhere. It's buried in there. No. I mean, I guess you don't, right? You don't think about brushing your teeth. You just go do it. And that's the subtle danger of habit. Do we ever do an inventory of the things once they become habit? Do we even notice them? See, it's almost as if you can't see habit once it's ingrained in your life, and so you don't even know to ask the question about whether the habit is still serving a purpose in your life. And this, if anything, is where the people who know us the best and love us the most have to be a window into our life. Uh-oh. Whenever you ask a question, it's never good, because I usually don't have the answer. What?
How about the habits that are actually negative that time? They will push these for a reason. But after a period of time of being a habit, the same way you're saying, you look and see that that is no longer useful. It's actually pulling you down. And to change that habit and to be able to overcome that habit and create a habit. But each day is really affecting you in a negative way.
I think we just have to circle around and say what I've already said. The first challenge is, do I even know that I have the habit? Right? Let's think about something amusing. Do you have some quirky mannerism that drives your wife nuts?
I was going to say, that's one of my favorite things about being married. Is
what, annoying your wife? Yeah, I feel that way too. But
she can see things that I do. I started for some reason, and I just do them. And I don't even know why anymore. And then I'll do the same. I'll talk to her about things. And I'm like, hey, why do you do that? And then, you know, we constantly reevaluate our lives, and our lives together and our separate lives. And I think it really helps fix those habits that we put in place that are no longer useful. And it helps us develop new habits to, you know, to work on those things.
And family is a great place to have those conversations. Hopefully it's a safe place to have those conversations. Honestly, it isn't always safe. Sometimes the way in which we express our displeasure with mannerisms of somebody else or goofy, quirky habits of someone else is not in a friendly and positive way. But if we can craft conversations in our home that are helpful and then involve our children in those conversations, first to just watch us have the conversation and then to actually become involved in the conversations themselves. I need to find where I have the quote that I'm looking for. Okay, let's get down to the bottom of page 2. There's a couple of them we're going to read. If it's worth doing in the first place, then it's certainly worth evaluating. Evaluated experiences make us better. Experience alone just makes ruts for living. Can you put your finger on a time, maybe even a place, where you go for regular evaluation, personal evaluation? See, if you can't answer that question, then the answer is probably no. Do you have a system in place in your own life where with a predictable frequency you go to evaluate your life? I've just got to say this. If there is no time, then what are the chances that you're actually living half your life not on purpose? See, remember this phrase. We've used it again and again, but there's never enough time to do everything, but there's always enough time for the most important things. If the evaluation of your life is an important thing, it will start to take precedence over other things.
If you're not self-evaluating, aren't you setting yourself up?
You can be. Yeah.
You said half. It could be 100%.
What's that?
You said half. Wasting half your life. It
could be your life. Oh, it could be. It could be your whole life. But who wants to hear that? Let's give the guy the benefit of the doubt. Come on. That was harsh first thing in the morning. All right. And then we move up to the top of page 3. Practice doesn't make perfect. It just makes permanent. Now think about that. So there's where something becomes habit. So the thing that was practiced, there's still a little bit of discipline involved. I have to make myself do that. But over a period of time, what's being implied is practice doesn't make perfect, it just makes permanent what was practiced. Only practice carefully monitored, evaluated, and improved can make perfect. All right. So now, by now, we've pretty much exhausted our need for talk about self-discipline, but there's one question that everybody probably has. Well, what do I do about my commitment to follow Christ? Because we've talked an awful lot about self-discipline, but where does that fit in with being a disciple of Christ? But if you read the Scriptures, and you read them thoughtfully, what you see is that we voluntarily submit to God's rule and reign in our hearts. We invite the rule of God's discipline into our life, and in essence, God gives us, what we've said already, the veto power. Do you want to follow this or don't you? Do you want to be my follower or don't you? Do you want to be my disciple or don't you? And then Paul goes on to say, in verses like we've used before, that we need to each renew our minds. We need to, on a regular basis, readjust our minds. What does that mean? It means that there is a personal commitment. There's a personal effort needed to be a disciple of Christ. And so it's very consistent with self-discipline. It's very consistent with saying, I am voluntarily going to pick up the standards of Christ and place them into my life and use them as the boundary for my life. And because it's so consistently tied to purpose, the disciplines that Christ is going to ask from you may be different than the ones He's going to ask from me. It's unique. So if we were to draw everyone's self-discipline fence on this board, there'd be a degree of core overlap. And then there'd be areas where each of our areas of self-discipline would go out in a certain area. John perhaps spends 10 hours a week just preparing for a message and studying and reading and evaluating the meaning of this, that, or the other word. Whatever he does. I'm assuming he does. Say you do.
More than that.
Okay. Some of us aren't going to do that. So each of us has a unique fence, but there's going to be a common core. So when we come together to discuss things, we discuss the common core that we all have in common, but yet we can learn from each other. Because over a period of time, over 20 or 30 or 40 years of adult life, the fence is going to morph. So that the way you impose discipline on yourself at 30 is not going to look the way you impose discipline on yourself at 60. All right. Questions? Comments? All right. Incidentally, I'm going over a lot of this, but there's still stuff to read. So, like I've said to you every week, take time to read through the material. So we're going to get to the second part. The difference between the desire for more and the appreciation for what we have. And in essence, in case you're about to zone out, is this. The human mind can essentially only process one thought at a time. Right? Despite what we believe about ourselves being able to multitask and think about multiple things at the same time. I know that sounds endearing, and we'd all like to think that we can, but the reality is that we just switch from thing to thing that we think about. And so, only one dominant thought can occupy our thinking at the same time. And that is the dominant thought in a lot of our minds. If I were to ask you to carefully put down a list of the things that you don't have but that you want, you could probably fill a sheet of paper with them. Some of you could fill the entire legal pad with them. Have you ever noticed that while you're thinking about what you don't have, it's very difficult to think about what you're grateful for that you already do have? And that's the irony of it. That when we set ourselves up to want more, it becomes difficult to take inventory of what we already have. And it's why, as we've said so often, how many of us have places in our home, places in our garage, where we keep the more that we wanted yesterday that we don't have time to use today? You know what I'm saying? How many of us have more in the driveway? How many of us have more in the garage? The basement? the separate storage facility that we drive to visit with our more, because we can no longer hold it at home. And I'm not finding fault with any of us, because we're all guilty of it. What is it that makes us do that?
I think it's that competition to keep up with others. Because we're always it's a bad habit, but we're always comparing ourselves to what other people have. So if Vinny here has a nice Ferrari, I look at that and be like, why can't I have a Ferrari? So Ferrari, and they'll go up to the next best car. Well, I want that. So it's that bad habit of trying to keep up with others.
Where does that come from?
Facebook.
And so nobody wanted more before Facebook? Now, there are certain things about... Look, technology just accelerates our capability to do things that we were likely to do anyway.
Well, everything we do and everywhere we go, we're bombarded with advertisements for what we need.
Yeah, and there's a whole couple of paragraphs in here written precisely to address that. But every day people are telling us, reminding us, suggesting to us at least, that we are incomplete unless we have something. I'm sure it did. And that was before retail shopping. And Facebook. And so every day, someone is suggesting to us, probably multiple times a day, that there's something that we're missing that can contribute to either our happiness, our life satisfaction, or our ability to perform at a higher level. Now, let's be honest. Who doesn't want to have life satisfaction, happiness, and be able to perform at a better level? And who hasn't tried to buy that in a box pre-made? Right? We do that. So the challenge is for us to be able to first identify how the message appeals to us. Why does it appeal to us?
Because I think we have a yearning inside to be all those things.
Of course we do.
We need to be more, we just don't know what that is. Somebody says you should be a more faithful follower in Jesus Christ. Okay, but that doesn't tell me anything. Do I get a shirt that makes me that? Without going through the lessons and discipline and self-discipline and hearing how other people have failed against it, we don't learn how to apply those things to becoming. We think of it as a noun, something we can buy, a person, place, or thing, but it's a verb, it's something we're doing.
Just hold all that stuff. Anybody else want to add to that? Okay, well, here it is. Remember what we said we impose self-discipline on ourselves for? To live toward a purpose. Until you know who you are and why you're here, then you don't know what you need. If I gave you a check for $10,000, which wouldn't buy as much as it used to, but if I gave you a check for $10,000 and I said, go make yourself happy, are you going to be this for the rest of the morning? Go make yourself happy. What would you do?
Give it to
your
wife.
Give it to your wife?
I won't be happy or right. I just bought a lot of happiness.
See, before we can answer the question about what we should pursue to make us happy, we need to understand who we are and why we're here. Until you understand who you are and why you're here, then you don't know what you should buy. And I'm not talking about some trivial excursion into the unusual. I'm not talking about the outdoor gear that you have hanging in your closet that you used once and then it hung there for the... I'm not talking about those kinds of things. I'm talking about bigger things. And I'm not talking about them from our own lives. I'm talking about them for our children's lives. Here's what we need to be able to do. We need to be able to teach our children critical thinking skills. Why does that message appeal to me? Are they able to guarantee that what they promised they can live up to? And we know this as adults, right? Don't we? We're promised something. If you buy this new car, It's going to whatever it's going to do, right? Why are cars always sold with women? No offense, ladies. Just nothing happening here. Just go back to your pink clothes over there. Why is that?
They know it entices the man.
Yeah, and there's a subtle implication, right? Somehow my wife is, if I'm married, is going to think I'm sexy or I'm this, I'm that, if I have this, or some, right? And you think, well, I'm too sophisticated for that. Really? No, you're not. You just think you're too, they've already evaluated you and they know that the message works. I wish I could remember the exact words that of the Mick Jagger song from years gone by. He can't be a man because he doesn't smoke the same cigarettes as me. Anybody remember that? Am I the only one in the room who was old enough to?
The materialistic stuff is all temporary. You're going to have that new car. You're going to drive it for 3 months, but fourth month you get in there, it's just another car. But when you accomplish a goal, that sits with you forever. It wants more.
How old? Let me. Can you hang on to that thought for a minute? There's your 15-year-old kid. There's the 5 years of that car. See, the 5-year life expectancy of that car is a full third of his life. And the first 5 years, he wasn't even aware of anything, right? So that 5-year long car life is half of his conscious life. You're how old?
13.
That car by this time only represents 1/6 of your life. So, yes, but what I'm saying is, to your child, that car is going to bring him happiness for years because he's only lived a few years. You, by this time, are sophisticated enough to know I'm going to go through 10 cars in my lifetime. But you can't use the same level of reasoning. See, that argument doesn't work on your child who's only 15 years old. You've got to reduce it down to the point that he can understand it. Because despite how much we believe it, okay, we've used this before, but let me introduce it again. Children are not capable of abstract thinking skills until somewhere into their mid to late teens. It doesn't fully develop until their late teens or early 20s. So when you start to use abstract thinking skills or explanations with a 12-year-old, it doesn't connect as well as it could. Yeah, well, I totally forgot about you. Thank you.
I was just going to say, sometimes, whatever that object is, you kind of sell yourself on wanting that and how it's going to be better for your life and how it's going to be good. You sell yourself on the story of getting that. I'm getting that object, I'm getting whatever it is. And in a while, for a little bit, it's almost like that thing beats you back. And in a way, it becomes your idol, it becomes what you focus on, it becomes your goal. And in the big picture, it's really something that doesn't matter at all. Because the car that you just bought brand new, that's so special, you start to want to clean it, spend your time on cleaning it, when you could have been doing other things. And in 5 years, just like you're saying, that thing that was so special, is now you've moved on to something that you need to have, or something else that you want to have. And it just keeps on going. It just matters what it is.
Now, I want to draw a line there. This is all true, but let me ask you a different question. Have you ever purchased something and been extremely glad you purchased it, even for years to come?
Sure.
Generally speaking, it is in somehow connected with the way you've chosen to live your life. So it's not as if more is always bad. More is only a distraction if it isn't more for the purpose that you're called to live for. All right, so for one person, the latest technology is merely a distraction and an expense. For another person, the latest technology actually helps them to do the very thing they're doing in life more effectively. So it's not as if we tell our children, no, you need a smaller fence of more. We help our children to understand that your more needs to fit the fence of your calling. I just want to make sure I'm not leaving anything important overlooked here. All right.
We can present that practical theology in very poor ways. I think at times I've said to my kids when Pinky's made something that they don't like to eat, and I'll say, you should be happy you're not in China where they don't eat. We can teach them very false things to try and help them to believe something that is true. Maybe there are people in China that don't eat. I've never been there. But I mean, an excuse why they should eat what Vicky made. And there are times I don't like what she's made. I'm like, oh, I'm going to choke this down. Setting the example. Or they'll say, like, I'm starving. And I say, well, why don't you come sit with me at the computer and we'll look at people who are really starving. But if it's not impacting me to do the very thing that I'm telling them to do, then it's done more harm than it has good.
And none of us gets this right all the time. I mean, let's face it, parenting is a demanding task, and it's not as if you can put your life on hold exclusively just to be a parent, right? You've got responsibilities of your own. You've got demands of your own, right? I mean, if you don't fulfill some of the things that are demanded and expected of you, then you don't keep the roof over their heads, too. And so we have to balance this out, and sometimes we want a quick explanation. There's nothing wrong, necessarily, with the kids in China food thing in a moment of haste. But then later on, there better be a meaningful conversation that takes place about that. And this is the thing. Every area of your life, including the way you parent, you need to evaluate it and ask yourself, is the way I'm doing this now likely to produce the result that I really want? And that's the question that we sometimes neglect to ask. And then, well, if it's not, what would I have to do differently in order to produce that result? So don't stop with, no, okay, because you don't want to beat yourself up, right? You never want to leave that time of self-reflection and evaluation saying, wow, I'm really a jerk, an idiot, a moron, and a bad parent. Instead, you want to start the conversation with, wow, I'm a jerk, I'm an idiot, I'm a moron, I'm a bad parent, but I'd like to get better. Yes? All right, so how do we be comfortable with this? How do I become comfortable with living in this appreciation for what I have? Because sometimes, let's be honest, what we have in the moment seems like it would not be a great deal to be appreciative for. Well, in exactly the same way as self-discipline is made possible, and here's one of the things that I didn't talk about self-discipline. Self-discipline is most powerful when I have hope. Now let's connect those two. Self-discipline is most powerful in life when I am a person who has a confident hope. Why? And if I don't believe there is anything out there or anything out there that I could ever reach, then I may as well grab all the happiness in the moment that I possibly can. But if I am a person of confident hope, then I can say no to things today because I have a confident belief that the thing that I am here for, I can reach tomorrow. Or the next day. Or the next day. So with that in mind, let's turn over to Ephesians, 3rd chapter. I'm going to quickly move you through a couple of verses. We have to be out of here at the dot of 9. Ephesians 3rd chapter, we're going to go to the last verse. Now to him who is able to do far more abundantly than all that we ask or think, according to the power at work within us. To him be glory in the church and in Christ Jesus throughout all generations, forever and ever. Amen. So that's sort of like a nice doxology planted right there in the middle of his letter. It's almost as if he wrote a letter, stopped the letter, thought he was done with the letter, and then perhaps even almost remembered some additional things he wanted to add. So let's read that again. Now to him who is able to do far more abundantly than all that we ask or think, according to the power at work within us, to Him be glory in the church and in Christ Jesus throughout all generations, forever and ever. Amen. That's a pretty bold promise, isn't it? Now, does it mean that He's going to make possible for us everything that we want? What's it saying?
We're not here for us, we're here for Him.
And to the degree that we are able to align our life with our life purpose and our life mission, then God will work things out to achieve what He wants to achieve. That's what we would call, as disciples, success. All right? Now let's turn over to Matthew 6. Let's start at the 25th verse. Therefore I tell you, do not be anxious about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothing? And then we get into this famous verse. Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow, nor reap, nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? So the premise of everything that He says is built on what foundation? Don't look at me, look at the verse. That's the promise. What's the foundation? We have value. We have value. Because we have value, God commits to care for us. He says, look at the birds. God cares for the birds. In other words, paraphrase, here's what Jesus is saying. God likes birds, so He takes care of them. So if we put our lives and the birds' lives on the balance and we say, who does God like more? Birds or humans? God likes humans more. Why some days? I don't understand. Frankly, there's a lot of humans that I'm not sure why God would like them. Myself included some days. But here's the point. Jesus has said, God values humans and therefore He's committed to care for them. Now, have you ever worried about what you needed? What you wanted? What you felt you didn't have? What you were going... Look at this promise here. Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns. Now, why does He bring that up? Because these are things that every human being does in one form or another. So I've never noticed this until just the other night, and I'm looking at this verse, and it just struck me. Do you realize that from Genesis all the way through to Revelations, it is a continuation of the commitment to cause and effect, the law of cause and effect. If you do this, you'll get that. If you do this good thing, you'll probably get this good thing times something. If you do this bad thing, you'll probably get this bad thing times something. That's sowing and reaping. Okay, what Jesus is saying is the birds don't even do the sowing and reaping and God is committed to care for them. You guys do the sowing. And when you sow good, you do reap good. And then you have surplus and you store the surplus. Now, if you are meticulous and careful in fulfilling what God's called you to do, do you not think God is going to care for you? God likes birds and He cares for the birds who don't even exert the effort to do that. When a bird wakes up in the morning, it doesn't go out and check its granary. It says, I'm hungry. I wonder what's outside the door to eat. And yet you and I have meticulously built systems in place to sow, to reap, and to store into barns. How do we do that today? Okay, that's the storing into barns. We do all that, right? We save. We go to work. We invest. We do all this stuff. And yet, how many of us obsess over that kind of stuff? You ever worried about that? Well, you don't. You're the exception to the rule. I should break eye contact with you. Have any of the rest of us normal people ever worried about that? Of course. It's natural. Remember what we said about two thoughts can't tend to occupy the mind at the same time? So we're either
Well, my war is up here is gone. We're either focused on more that we don't have or appreciation for what we do have. And we're also either focused on worry about what we don't have or a confident belief that God is going to care for us and therefore we can pursue mission. Because one of the greatest temptations that we have is to divert from mission in order to pursue survival. Have you ever been torn by that? Divert from mission to pursue survival. I think I know that God would want me to do this thing, but instead I have to go chase that thing. And here's the funny thing. Our pursuit of more just enslaves us to the commitment to have to go chase after more to pay for the more. That's the irony of it all. That because we're not confident in who we are and our identity in Christ and our purpose and our mission here, we go chase after other things to make us happy, but we don't even have the resources to obtain what it takes to make us happy. And so we mortgage our future to get personal happiness in the present. And we do that because we don't trust that if we live our lives according to the purpose that God calls us to, that we're going to get any happiness and satisfaction. So we may as well just be honest with our kids and say, I've struggled with that, I still do struggle with that, but to the degree that I have been able to put that struggle behind me and discover that when I pursue mission, I do find satisfaction, to the degree that I'm able to do that, I do experience contentment and joy. And at the end of the day, honestly, if you were to distill it all down, that's what human beings want. Satisfaction, contentment, and joy.
Well, we see the opposite of that a lot in today's society, where young kids getting married want their parents' house, and it's taking them a lifetime to be able to afford the mortgage on. We jump into a 30-year mortgage that wasn't available 30 years ago because of not thought of that you would take out a loan for half or a third of your life to pay for this house. And I have a friend's couple who just got married 3 weeks ago. They bought a $220,000 house when they can really afford to live in a mobile home that's probably broke down. But they think that their parents have a $250,000 house. That's what they expect they should be given as a married couple. That we don't want to earn it when we can be given it, just pay over the lifetime, our lifetime, to make something, to find a false satisfaction.
So let's take his example. So here's a couple, they start out. They've been raised by parents, they have certain expectations, they have certain ideals that they're going after. Has the $250,000 house in any way, in the purchase of that house, in any way influence their future and what they'll be able to do in their future?
Absolutely.
Of course it
influences it. It's now defined it.
Well, I'm being gracious in my question, okay? It may have defined it. Yes. Do you see how subtle that is, though? Where did that expectation come from? How did they acquire that expectation? It's the cumulative effort of everything that has been poured into them for 18 or 20 or 25 years of life. And remember what I said several weeks ago, your kids swim in a sea of culture. And they dip their toe in the culture of our family. So your message needs to be extremely compelling and strong. Not overbearing, but it needs to make sense, it needs to be believable, and it needs to be practiced in the home. Because your children are going to have more exposure to messages outside your home than inside it. That's just inevitable. And so at the end of this, what we have to say is that if you want to, and you heard me say this a couple of weeks ago, if you want to change the world, raise great kids. Well, how many kids do you have? How many relationships will they develop over the course of their adult lifetimes? You bet. How many relationships do you have? You're in sales of one form or another, right? You have influence over probably hundreds, if not thousands, of people over the course of 1 year's time. If you want to change the world, influence your children. Because what are we? We're containers for the Spirit of God that are mobile and travel throughout humanity. Every one of us, a God container that can move throughout humanity and influence other people. We're basically a can to put God in, if you will, with legs. All right. I've promised that I would get us out of here by 9. What I would like to do is have a few moments for discussion or questions before we wrap this up, if there are any. And if not, we'll be free to go. But I'd really encourage you to be back here next week when we do the wrap-up.